common denominator tonight of all of us. We all have emotional scars. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. They lied to us. Go. Number 8, 4, an ability to inspire, encourage people, motivation. And I think there are a number of factors here, folks. Jared learned this in one of his classes in leadership. You can't push a piece of string. You have to grab it and get in front of it. And that's true with people. You can't lead from behind. And so many times in the church and in Christendom, we're playing catch up. And we just can't do that. We've got to get ahead. And even, in February and March, I started talking to my leadership, what is our church going to look like post-COVID? And we started planning for things like that. I think that as a leader, you should never ask your people to do anything you haven't done or wouldn't do. That is a key. People follow character. That is very biblical. Ethos, credibility, if you will. And when a leader has lost their character, they've lost everything. I would suggest to you tonight that as a leader, people need to trust you. It is as simple as that. And the best relationship advice I can give you tonight is never violate trust. I'm not saying it can't be fixed. I'm saying you just don't want to go there. And a lot of times, beloved, we think, and this is how human beings think, that you make a mistake, you goof up. You ever been to a restaurant and they messed up your steak? And the manager comes out, they give you the half-hearted apology and, oh, hey, we're really sorry. Let us take that back to the kitchen. We'll throw in a free dessert. That doesn't cut it if you understand customer service. That's not enough. That person needs a lesson in customer service. I do things like that. It embarrasses Connie to no end, but somebody's got to teach people stuff like this. A really cool book is called How Full Is Your Bucket? It's a quick read. It's conservative. They did a lot of studies on trust and things like that. And they found this, that one negative, think how many positives it takes to undo one negative. And we think one and one. No, it can take up to 9 positives to undo one negative. Wow. Again, you ever bought a lemon? You ever bought a bad car? Ever had something nickel and dime you to death? There are 2 brands of vehicles I'll never buy again. I won't tell you what they are because they may be your favorite. Maybe they work for you. They didn't work for me. I'm not going to live long enough to buy 9 more. You don't have the luxury. There are a couple of restaurants I will never go to again. I'm not going to tell you what they are. One of them has locked me out. They banned me, but no, not really. But because I gave them a lesson in customer service. And I'm nice when I do this. That's my job. I am here to eliminate shoddy from Central Maine. It's what I do, okay? So, but I don't care if they're giving away food. I'm not going to go. There are certain people, that aren't going to do my taxes. I'm not going to go to for medical advice and things like that. We don't have the luxury of being a wing nut. And again, there are too many fruit cakes in Christendom tonight, and the world is tired of it. We need to be fruit stands. Another study they did, they went to a major, and this is how full is your bucket. They went to a major metropolitan area, city hall, with permission, and they watched couples applying for a marriage license. Now, you would think that would be a fairly happy time of life. I mean, I remember when I got mine, it was kind of cool. And they observed the exchanges between the couple, positive and negative. And they estimated that if it wasn't at least a 3-to-1 ratio, positive to negative, within 10 years, the couple would be divorced. They went back 10 years later, they hit it with a 70% accuracy rate. Yeah. You say something stupid, You better start saying a whole lot of positive things. But as leaders, leaders have character. Doesn't mean we're perfect, but people will follow character. Nehemiah was a man of character, beloved. Something else I want you to note. Listen to how people use their pronouns. Just listen. Listen to how many I's they use. That intrigues me. Listen to how they use their other pronouns. And that when somebody comes to me and says, "Pastor, I really like your church," what does that tell me about how they view the church? They don't feel like they're a part of our church, do they? It makes me sad. I've had people attend there for an extended period of time. They're still referring to it as your church. When is it going to become our church, folks? Someone ever come up to you and said, "You've got a problem." Well, that's a great way to start a conversation. Yeah, Pastor. Somebody comes up to you, "Pastor, you've got a problem." Uh-huh. Yeah, 3 minutes before you step into the pulpit. Yay! No. We have a problem. And that was Nehemiah. He goes back. He doesn't do anything for 3 days. You can imagine, small, you know, hometown hero returns, but there's secrecy. He went on a night tour. He's seeing it in his mind. He's visualizing the plan. And then he gathers the residents together, and he said, and his pronouns are beautiful, beloved, in chapter 2. "We are in distress. We have a problem. We, you're one of the most powerful men on the planet. You don't have a problem, man. You can return to that cushy desk job anytime you want to." But he identified, "Let us rise up and build." And then he took the piece of string and said, "We're going this way." And people said, "Yup." And that's what leaders do. They have the ability to motivate. But a lot of it, beloved, it isn't science or mystical or magic. It's in these common sense things like being consistent, having character, simple things like using your pronouns. Number 5, a willingness and an ability to endure opposition in order to reach the ultimate goal. Beloved, just because it's God's will, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. We've forgotten that. That poor guy, he dealt with discouragement because the people got bummed out. He dealt with dissension. He dealt with a money issue. The Samaritan population just drove him crazy. It was everywhere. But he dealt with it. And by the way, that was something he never delegated. And he could have just retreated into his office and said, "Yeah, when it's over, come and see me." But he didn't. He took it by the horns and said, "We are going to fix this." Beloved, we live in a quitting culture. You know that. Relationships, marriages, schools, people quitting on their churches, things like that. I see a real restlessness in our culture, particularly amongst young men. And I know most young men go through a restless period. I know I did. Probably drove my dad crazy. But at some point, it's time to put your big boy pants on and begin to act like a man. You know, you ever heard the term man boy in our culture? Scripture knows nothing of stuff like that. And the quitting, the restlessness, and stuff like that, and beloved, it's hurting. It's hurting our culture. It's hurting our church. And it hurts, again, in ministry. The average stay of the average senior pastor now in America is less than 4 years. My word. No wonder churches are struggling. No wonder churches don't trust pastors. Because a guy comes in and says, "Let's go this way," and they begin to chart a course, and then they leave. They probably ran out of messages because they don't know enough about the Word of God and things like that. It's tragic. What your pastor has done, he is a curve breaker. What I've done at Kennebec Valley, and I pastor gracious people. I didn't intend to spend 29 years there, folks. then the people, you know, a lot of people, they're going to be really careful how they vote next time. Believe me. You know, and they asked me, they said, how long do you think you'll stay? And I just kind of surmised the situation. It was a horror show. I said, I think you need to man to stay about 10 years. And they said, okay. They asked me that at East Hodgson. Grampy Duff asked me that, Robin. He said, how long? Because they'd had a revolving door. And again, I'm 26 and a half, and I don't think I've got 6 months worth of preaching material. And I swallowed hard, and I said, I'll try to stay 5 years. And I mean, that pleased him. Whatever. And again, the Lord got me through 8. But, I mean, those, you aren't seeing stuff like that anymore. And by the way, in ministry, 4 years is the break point. You lose your new pastor smell after the first 4 years. I have that old pastor stench right now. I haven't had the new pastor smell for decades. And it's at a break point. And so they have to be really, and young men, when you go to a church, you need to know that at 4 years, okay, the honeymoon is over. And now you're starting to know people, they're starting to know you, and it is time to roll up your sleeves and go to work. And leaders understand that. They understand that it's longevity to lead a ministry, to lead a church. And that's where prayer comes in. Again, with Nehemiah, 11 prayers in 13 chapters. In every set of circumstances, long prayers, short prayers, prayers for deliverance, prayers for wisdom. It's just really some really cool stuff. Number 6, an ability to delegate responsibilities to others. Leaders struggle with this, pastors struggle with this. And again, sometimes it's their own demise because they think there's an S on their chest and they came out of a phone booth and they didn't. And they've got to learn how to delegate. But some aren't secure enough to delegate. And I'm secure enough to, you know. I don't need to be cleaning the building and shoveling the walk. I don't need to be preaching in every service. And I'm in my pulpit 46 to 48 Sundays every year. Because that's what they pay me to do. I don't farm out many Sunday mornings because that's my job. I am fussy who I let feed my people. And that's why I'm humbled to be here, because I suspect your pastor has the same standard, and he's got me here this week, you know, shoveling out fast food. How's that? But, you know, I farm out prayer meetings, Sunday nights, and everything. But I'm not, again, beloved, I'm not insecure. And when you know, Pastor Josh, talented guy, people like Pastor Josh. That's good. You should like Pastor Josh. You need somebody on staff who's likable. That's not me, okay? I'm not the likable one in my family. Connie is. I wish I could have brought Connie up with me some night this week. You're just falling in love with her. She's that little redhead from Charlie Brown, okay? Yeah, it was love at first sight. You'd overlook the fact that she's from Colorado. You'd think she's a real Mena. But just because you have, you know, kittens in the oven, you don't call them biscuits, as Tim Sample said. But, you know, she's kind of been assimilated into Maine culture now. But I'm not the nice one on staff. I'm not insecure from that. I've started to let Pastor Josh do Sunday morning services because he may be the man. But I made sure he was ready. I didn't set him up to fail. And I keep these things spaced out. I don't want to overwhelm him. And things like that. Nehemiah, like I say, the guy is physical. He kind of has an engineering mind. He didn't go back, beloved, just to rebuild walls. He went back to rebuild people. But the physical had to be in order first. And he gets the walls rebuilt, and we come to chapter 7, and he's stuck. I don't know what to do. And so we just took a census. And then it comes to mind, hey, we need a revival, and you'll notice there's a seamless transition. Ezra the scribe comes into the picture, begins to teach. Nehemiah fades away because he's not a teacher. It is a beautiful, beautiful, two men without egos. And he just transitions into the teaching time, and there's a revival, and people get rebuilt. And that's what he went back for, beloved. But again, you shouldn't be threatened by somebody, you know, who's taller or better looking or more handsome or more beautiful or more talented. Again, it's that comparison thing that we talked about earlier in the week, and it is lose. And don't be afraid to delegate. You'll live longer. And don't micromanage and don't bird dog. Number 7, a joy and fulfillment in seeing all the parts come together in a finished product. It's really neat. And this is what pushes leaders' buttons. It's that other end whenever that takes place. There's a dedication ceremony, beloved. But you know what? They didn't dedicate the walls until they had dedicated people. And that's appropriate. The end of chapter 9 into chapter 10, there's this declaration of distinction. They come into a covenant relationship with God. Nehemiah was the first one to sign it. There's something about signing something. You want to make sure you're serious about commitment? Write it down on a 3x5 card, sign it, and put it on the fridge. You'll do it. You'll be reminded of it every time you see it. Nehemiah is the first one to sign it. And then, after the people are dedicated, and it's really cool, and I love the instruments here, they get two groups of musicians on the top of the wall. One walks around the city this way, the other walks around the city this way, and it is loud. And there's nothing wrong with that. It was Nehemiah's ragtime band, and they just praised God that day. And that's what he went back for, beloved. And so that's leadership. And that's what our churches are really going to need in the next decade in our state. All right, I'm going to go through. I was afraid this was, I knew you wouldn't listen quickly enough. And so I am not taking any responsibility, so I knew I'd get pressed. And I'm thankful I have as much time as I do have with the mercy thing. Mercy, beloved, the difference between grace and mercy. And so if you want an interesting study sometime, study the introduction only to Paul's letters. Don't speed read them, because they set the tone for the letter. Some are formal, some are informal, some very serious, some very happy. But they all have a common denominator. There is always a bequest of grace and peace. And grace is always, grace and mercy. And grace is always first, and theologically it has to be. Grace is simply unmerited favor, period. Please do not refer to this age as the age of grace. This is the church age. Some people, you know, it's like they act like there's no grace in the Old Testament. Well, what do you do with Noah, who found grace in the eyes of the Lord? That's the only way that God can deal with sinful people, on the basis of unmerited favor, period. Mercy is the relieving of suffering. And so we have this unmerited favor. But God, vertically, he is also dealing with our suffering and an eternity that will be the epitome. That is true horizontally. The gift of mercy, and it's sort of an unsung gift. Probably it's like teaching. It's the gift that maybe nobody thinks they have or nobody wants. But the gift of mercy is eliminating or relieving or dealing with human misery. And sometimes we have to do it physically before we can deal with people internally. We have to deal with the physical needs first. You got to get your belly full. You got to get healed up. You got to have medicine and things like that. Beloved, we live in a callous culture. You know that. Brutal. The violence. I have never seen such a divided country, and I'm very concerned. The mental health issues. I'm dealing with it every day in a college campus. Students shooting me emails, things like this. Hey, can I have an extension on this assignment? My mental health hasn't been good recently. Now, some people are just trying to schmooze an old man. I know that. But in many instances, it's real. You've got law enforcement here in the church. You're dealing with it on an entirely different level than I'm dealing with it. And you can have it. because what I see is enough for me. But it's just, there's no mercy, beloved. At the end of the parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus asked the lawyer, the religious leader that asked him the question, who was the neighbor to the guy who got mugged? And what did that guy say? The one that showed mercy on him. And notice, he wouldn't even say Samaritan because he was a racist. And Jesus said, go thou and do likewise. He relieved his suffering. He dealt with it. He made it personal. He internalized it. And beloved, that's what the gift is. It's showing kindness. It ties in, I think, with exhortation. It may go a little deeper than exhortation. But it is a necessary, maybe a low-profile gift. It's a one-on-one gift. But it's necessary. And Paul says the person who shows, has the gift of mercy, and he adds a little addendum there, should do it with cheerfulness. And what that means is this. It isn't, you ever had to do something, you never did something, ever did something because you just had to do it? Yep, me too. You ever, you know, thought or said to someone, I'll help you out this time, but that's it? Mm-hmm, me too. Yep. That's the idea that he isn't conveying there. It's the idea that you just show mercy with no strings attached. That's the concept of the gift. And you continue. And there's always going to be an outlet for this gift. Beloved, our culture hurts. A common denominator tonight of all of us, we all have emotional scars. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. They lied to us. They meant well, but they lied. They lied. You know, in seventh grade, I was 5'1", I weighed 105 pounds. I was the smallest kid in my class, male or female. I had acne. I got beat up. I got picked on. I lost my milk money 4 or 5 days a week, too ashamed to tell my parents. Now, don't feel bad for me. It's been a long time since somebody's picked on me, although it happens and people try to do it in ministry. I'm very thankful for growth spurts and weights. I've attempted to take advantage of both, okay? But there's a lot of scars out there, beloved. People hurt. They just hurt. And I see it, and that's why they can't get through a freshman-level speech class, because they hurt. And there's no safety net. And we need to be sensitive to that, sensitive. And sometimes for me, it disgusts me. And that's wrong. That's wrong. That's my problem. The individual who is the epitome of this gift is the Apostle John, the son of thunder. God indeed has a sense of humor. And the Holy Spirit just transforms him, and he becomes a very gentle, tender man. Let's get on through the characteristics quickly. Number one, a spirit of sensitivity and an ability to understand emotions. And I put this under sensitivity, again, tender. Tender. People who have this gift are just tender, gentle people. And again, no gender barriers. Guys, men, you could have this gift. You know, we shouldn't just project this onto women. You think of John. John uses the word love more than any other author in the New Testament, in his gospel, and particularly in his first epistle. People who have this, they focus in on emotion. And again, think of the structure of the Gospel of John. It's unique. It's not one of the synoptic Gospels. It doesn't synthesize. One of the ways to outline the Gospel of John is Jesus' encounter with people. It's a people-oriented Gospel. And so it's probably six of the disciples in chapter 1, Philip and Nathaniel, being focused in on. It's his mother in chapter 2. It's Nicodemus in chapter 3. It's the woman at the well in chapter 4. It's the nobleman at the end of chapter 4. It's the paralyzed man in chapter 5. It's the multitude in chapter 6. It's the woman caught in the very act of adultery in chapter 8. It's the blind man in chapter 9. It's Mary, Martha, and Nicodemus in chapter 11. And chapter 12 is the triumphal entry. In the first half of the book of John, there are just these people, and they've all got a problem. They're all hurting. They've all got an emotional scar. And the master deals with it. Closely associated with that, an emphasis upon emotion and the inner man. Again, read the gospel and read 1 John. Here are the words that will jump out. Beloved, joy, love, fellowship, hope, confidence, lack of guilt. John puts us inside of people. I'll paraphrase Jesus' conversation with a nobleman. The Greek is, he was a member of Herod's court. This man is wealthy. He is powerful. His little boy is about to die. And money can't buy a cure. This man comes to Jesus and is begging. How many times has this man begged in his life? It isn't likely. People have come to him to beg. Master, you've got to come heal my son. He's heard of Jesus. This is Jesus' response, and I'm paraphrasing it. I want more than just an adrenaline junkie. I want more than just a casual follower. Do you understand what it really means to follow me? Yes, Master, come anyway. He puts you inside that man. Think of the woman caught in the act of adultery. She was set up, by the way. The Mosaic law said, you brought the man. Isn't it convenient he got away? He either was a religious leader or somebody they paid off. You think of that woman. I mean, what was she wearing? Was she clothed? It's complete embarrassment, wasn't it? The shame. Let him as well as sin cast the first stone. My word. Nicodemus might have been up to 60 years old. Doesn't know how to get to heaven. That's what John, read it from that perspective. He is putting us in, Mary, they've run out of wine. You know why I believe she said that? She wanted to be vindicated because there was a Roman garrison outside of Nazareth, and there was a rumor that a Roman soldier impregnated her, and that's where Jesus came from. And people could count to 10 in that day and age, and they knew that Joseph and Mary came together, and the baby firstborn son came long before they'd been together 10 months. Yeah. There's some really cool stuff happening there. But it's one who had insight into the gift of mercy who is telling us about that. Number three, an understanding that people are vulnerable. They are. Again, I'll get back to Nicodemus. And beloved, I believe the reason he came by night because he was ashamed. He could control his schedule. And Jesus read his mind. You got to be born again. And by the way, beloved, Nicodemus gets it. There seems like a disconnect there. There's no disconnect. And when Jesus says to him, you're a teacher in Israel, a better translation of that article is, you're the teacher. You can make a strong case. He was the head Pharisee in the country. And again, 55, 60 years of age. And you don't know how to get to heaven? And born again was a symbol for what? You got to start over. And Nicodemus is thinking, my word, my training, my what? Lord, and that's why he says, how can a man be born again? Lord, how can someone like me start over? He gets it. And Jesus speaks about birth by the Spirit. He didn't make that up. He's quoting from Isaiah. Really cool stuff, beloved. But this guy hurts. The blind man, they excommunicated him. The religious leaders had so much power, they took away his salvation. How much of an ego was that? And it's after that, in chapter 10, that Jesus gives the Good Shepherd dialogue. John 10, 1 through 9. You've been rejected by the establishment. Come into the fold. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Emotional needs being met. But it's John. Beloved, everyone is emotionally vulnerable. Even crusty old pastors who are dinosaurs, who seem like they don't have feelings, okay? People are fragile, handle with care. People are fragile, handle with prayer. And again, 2 Corinthians 1:11 is one of the ways that we can help each other. A tendency to attract and be attracted to people who are experiencing problems. Connie has the gift of mercy. It's part of her mix. And again, she just, you know, she says sometimes, I just must have that look. No, you have that gift. And if you have the gift, people are going to sense that, and they're going to come to you for help. And you're going to seek people out who need help. But that's it. But that's what they're into. They can sense this. Again, in John chapter 13, the upper room discourse, Jesus has just said, one of you are going to betray me. And nobody said, yeah, I knew that Judas was a snake in the woodpile. He blended in that well, didn't he? Yeah. And they're all, whoa. Note this, even Peter knew enough to keep his mouth shut. It's about the only time. But what did Peter do? He bumps who? John. And says, you ask him. Why? Because even then, that gift, and that's what people do when they're hurting, when they're vulnerable, they're going to seek out that person with the gift of mercy. Number five, a need for friendship in which there is mutual commitment. Again, friendship, loyalty, it's a big deal to people with the gift of mercy. Think of how, in his gospel, John never refers to himself by his name. How does he always refer to himself? The disciple whom Jesus loved. 6 times. You can flush him out. Yeah. Now, Jesus loved all of them, didn't he? But there was something special between Jesus and John. In the first 12 chapters of the book of Acts, there's a special connection between John and Peter. And that's interesting, isn't it? Mercy and the prophet hanging out together. But they did. But that's the way they're wired. They just want to connect, and they're loyal in their friendships. Commitment. Number six, a need to measure acceptance by physical closeness and quality to time. John was a member of the, quote, inner circle. Here's a study for you. The inner circle, it is recorded, they were called apart on 3 occasions. Here's the common denominator. I'll let you do the rest. The common denominator was death. I haven't figured that out yet. There's a series there. There's about 10 messages there, I think. We can't do it in 3. He was a member of the inner circle. At the Last Supper, and again, Da Vinci, it's a masterpiece, but it's not historically correct. They were not sitting linear at a table. You notice in the back, the window was open and it's daylight. That's completely flawed. So just so you know, it was night, they were in an upper room, and they reclined around a table on their elbow, and they were very close, which is why their feet needed to be clean, because most likely your feet were in close proximity to somebody else's nose. And John is what? He is reclining on Jesus' chest. Now, guys, think about that. The list of people that can put their head on my chest, right? I mean, this guy's I'll take a bullet for. But you're not going to put me. You're not going to put your head on my chest. Sorry. I mean, to us, that's whoa. And again, our culture. There's a lot of cultural stuff here. In that, I was in Peru a number of years ago, and again, very demonstrative. And Sunday morning service, we go to church. And these little, 5-foot Peruvian women come up, and you stick out your hand. They just bypass that sucker, reach up, grab you by the neck, pull you down, and lay a wet one on you. I mean, that's, whoa, okay? Yeah. You know those people, you're talking to them, when they're talking to you, and they got to touch you too? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. And I'm, I'm retreating, and they're charging, and I'm just... Because I got a big bubble around me. There's just not a lot of people I let into my personal space. And it's a cultural thing, beloved. It's a nonverbal thing. And that could be a good indicator if somebody has the gift of mercy, they're just touching people. Because that's just what they do. They're not trying to annoy you or make you uncomfortable. Maybe some sick people are, but most of them aren't. Basically, it's just part of the gift. And again, it's the time thing. They just really want to spend time together. But boy, how we, we need all the gifts, beloved. But again, our kind words, those practical things that we can do, to relieve, suffering. I mean, who ever thought in the state of Maine, we'd need food banks and clothing drives and a lot of us, that's just come about in our day and age, hasn't it? Wouldn't have happened for those of us who were older. And guess what? No one would have taken the food. They'd have been too proud. Yep. But there's so much suffering out there. This gift, again, it is so, so essential. Okay, time to be done. Folks, I say sincerely, again, I have had fun this week. I'll let you know a little secret about teaching and public speaking. An audience will either energize you or drain you. And that's been one of the problems of my church of preaching to mass. It's hard. I don't like it. And there's some people who choose to wear masks, and I get it, and there are some people who should wear masks. And we're trying to balance safety and testimony. But having said it, you've energized me this week. You've come out, you've been here a lot of nights, some of you have been here every night, 4 to 5, 5 out of 5, wow. This is a special place, folks. So it's been really, really cool. If you know more tonight than you did Monday night, I'm a happy camper. I'd love to do it again sometime, it has been fun. It's been very humbling to fill in for Wendell. I believe he had a good week at Word of Life. Again, somebody listen. So, like I say, that is tomorrow morning's breakfast, the cake, the breakfast of champions. My three monkeys, I am going to be the most popular Grampy in Herman tomorrow. Trust me.